30 September 1971 in NRL. Okay, we're talking about ferrite switches.
But even if you really broke your back to match everything, standing rate ratio at 102 or something like that over the band of the receiver, it is still virtually impossible to get away from errors of 5 or 10 degrees from the source. And of course the isolator, but even better, the circulator, knock that error way down. A factor of 10 or 100.
About what time was this when you saw this article and started working on the ferrite?
About 1950, 52, somewhere.
Oh, that early.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, the applique, well, then the obvious thing to do with a circulator is to, instead of using a fixed magnet, to switch it and use it to replace the ferrite switch, which would give both the advantage of the impedance isolation, get rid of this calibration error, but would also get rid of the dipper disc, which almost always been used up until that time.
Right.
Certainly had always been used in short wavelengths, or some artificial replacement for it. But, and that had all sorts of advantages. You could switch between two antennas, or you could switch between anything you wanted to. So that led to the development of this 3-centimeter radiometer, which was used in the 50-foot in 56. And that radiometer was actually in development for 2 or 3 years, held up by these eclipses and stuff. But the ferrite switch and stuff was actually built, I think, like in 52 or 53. It just sat there for 2 or 3 years. Well, anyway, in 56, this was, I guess, Haddock left somewhere in 55 or something like that. And, well, again, for various reasons, with Haddock leaving and with Hagen finally being sort of saturated with eclipses, this made it possible for me to work full-time on this radiometer and get it in the 50-foot. And, immediately on putting that radiometer in, first thing we did was look at Venus, and we asked for a month's time because we wanted to look for a phase effect.
No.
In other words, we thought that the sunlit side of Venus should be hotter than the dark side, and we wanted to see if we could measure the surface temperature of Venus and also to see if the sunlit side were hotter than the dark side. Same sort of thing you did on the moon, you see, previously.
Right. But Venus had never been observed at radio wavelengths earlier. Now, so this was just your idea that it should be observable.
Yeah, based on the infrared temperature of 300 degrees.
And with, I guess, a reasonably low noise for that time, 3-centimeter receiver. I'm just trying to get a feel. I guess the main thing was the large dish usable at short wavelengths that enabled you...
It worked out that the...
To do it.
The antenna temperatures would be of the order of 2 or 3 degrees, and I guess 2, something like that, would be observable. And say we asked for, I guess we actually asked for 2 or 3 months' time, but they gave us 1 month. So we started out about a month before inferior conjunction. Our time was up right at inferior conjunction. And the first day we did pick up Venus, and it was relatively weak then. You see, it was not only farther from conjunction, but also farther from the Earth. It was forgotten now, but probably a degree or less in antenna temperature. But right away it was apparent that if it was thermal radiation from Venus, it wasn't at 300 degrees, it was at 600 degrees. The very first day that was apparent.
Really? You had no doubt about the signal?
Pardon?
You had no doubt about the alleged signal, shall we say, at that time, I mean?
We didn't have any real doubt. Of course, we had all sorts of doubts because everybody told us, and all the books told us, that this was impossible. And so we had all sorts of doubts. We had no doubts about our equipment because that equipment was very thoroughly designed, every individual component thoroughly tested, the overall system thoroughly tested, the calibrations very well checked, the thermal sources. We felt very sure about what we were measuring. But we couldn't feel very sure about Venus being at 600 degrees because all the real smart astronomers said this couldn't be so. And well, in fact, Wilt had worked out that there would be a greenhouse effect, assuming that there was carbon dioxide, as they thought there was. But he set an absolute upper limit of, it was 400 degrees for the possible temperature. So even with that assist from Wilt on the greenhouse, it was still impossible. Well, anyway, so we continued to measure Venus up to inferior conjunction, and we saw this downtrend in the brightness temperature as it got toward inferior conjunction. Come in. Inferior conjunction, and of course, the as Venus got closer, the antenna temperature went up like it was supposed to, and so forth. But then we got tossed out of the dish, and we couldn't follow it through on the other side of inferior conjunction.
But you said the brightness temperature was falling.
But the antenna temperature was going up as it should. But of course not as fast as it should if the brightness temperature weren't falling.
Right.
So anyway, we couldn't do any more. We got kicked out. And we begged and pleaded that we'd be allowed to put the 9 centimeter radiometer on to check to see if it had a thermal spectrum. So Hagen gave us 2 days on a weekend, about a month later. So we worked all night in a thunderstorm to mount that huge radiometer, which is in a box about this big and weighed a ton, up on the back of the 50-foot dish, run 10-centimeter waveguide this big all the way out to the focus. And the next day, measure Venus. And that measurement wasn't awfully good because it was still too close to the sun at that wavelength. We had some side lobe troubles. So they gave us 1 day, a month later, to try it again. And we went through the whole procedure again and got some fairly marginal measurement at 9 centimeters. Which could have been improved, of course, with a few days' time, but
yeah.
Well, it did indicate a thermal spectrum.
Now, was the dish being used 100% of the time now, or was this, once again, that this wasn't willing to give you time?
Oh, yeah, it was being used mainly for the hydrogen line. I think that may have been about the time that Lilly and Barrett were looking for OH, and they were screaming their heads off that you shouldn't waste time on the valuable antenna looking at Venus. In fact, we had a terrible time getting on the antenna at all for that reason.
Now, do you know if that experiment came out that they just did not have enough sensitivity to find OH? Or?
I've never understood why they didn't find it. When you ask them, their answer is that they didn't know the frequency well enough. I've never understood that answer. Maybe that's right, but it seems to me that
Let's see now, the Venus stuff was published, certainly, and that was an FJ. Now, what about the phase effect?
Well, that came later. But before that, another thing that we had in mind to do at 3 centimeters was to try to detect polarization on Crab Nebula. And we wanted to have some kind of comparison source anyway for the Venus measurements. So we looked at the Crab Nebula and Venus all day long every day during this 2 month period all the way across the sky. Of course, this inferior conjunction was in June 23rd, I think, so Venus and Taurus were practically in the same part of the sky all through the whole experiment. Anyway, we looked at both Venus and the Crab Nebula all day, shifting back and forth from one to the other. So we had this data on the Crab Nebula, taken with a linearly polarized feed all day long. So the parallactic angle at that declination rotated by something like 120 degrees, I think it was. And after the first month, we rotated the whole radiometer 90 degrees, so we could fill out the other part of the curve and verify if it really was a polarization effect or whether it was some other kind of systematic effect during the day. And those curves, in fact, did show that for one, I can't remember which one now, but I guess horizontal polarization during the day, the thing went up like this. For vertical polarization, it went down like this, as it should for polarization.
So what percentage was it approximately?
Yeah, I don't remember. 8%, I think.
And was this the first radio astronomical polarization detected? And had, I guess it was Schlosky that first proposed synchrotron radiation. No?
No.
Had that been proposed? I mean, did you have any idea where this polarization was coming
from? Oh, sure. That was why we looked for it.
And who was it then?
Well, synchrotron radiation for as an explanation for celestial radio sources was first proposed by Kiepenhaar for the galactic radiation and by Alfvén and Herlufsen for radio sources, discrete sources.
Yeah, can you tell me approximately where and when these proposals
were? I can give you the references. In fact, if you look in our polarization paper, we get the references.
Oh, okay, fine.
And this was in about 1950.
And they were saying this was for Cygnus A also, for the extragalactic.
I don't remember whether they specified particular sources. They were just suggesting this is a possible mechanism to explain the, this radiation, which by that time everybody agreed couldn't be thermal.
Yeah.
So there were these two independent suggestions of synchrotron radiation. Now, somewhere along in that same period of time, but I think even the Russians admit later, a whole bunch of Russians proposed things like this. Notably, I guess, Ginsberg and maybe Pikelner and, you know, a bunch of guys proposed synchrotron radiation for, and maybe independently, maybe they didn't even know about this stuff outside Russia. I don't know. And what Schlosky did, as far as I know anyway, is he's not the first guy that proposed synchrotron radiation for radio sources at all, not even in Russia, by my understanding. But what he did was to propose that not only the radio radiation from the Crab Nebula was synchrotron radiation, but also the optical. And that was done about 1953, that proposal.
I see.
And as a follow-up on his that proposal of his, a couple of Russians looked for optical polarization and found it.
And found it?
Yeah.
Before your radio polarization?
Yes.
So you did have that to go on, at least?
Yes.
So that optical polarization was a pretty strong proof, or not proof, but weight in on the side of synchrotron. And the radio
for the optical.
The radio just about clinched it for the radio.
Yeah, and that they were in fact the same process.
Right.
And also, I guess independently, Oort claims independently anyway, Oort and Walraven looked for optical polarization. And I think they didn't know about the Russian results, which in fact, though, had already been gotten. And they found polarization and actually made a polarization map, crude one, optically.
Mm-hmm.
And then according to Oort, Botta was over there and he showed Botta this. So Botta went back and took these famous photographs with the 200-inch, which show them with different sheets of Polaroid, which showed the polarization very definitely, and then Vulture, of course, took Botta's photographs and analyzed them and got these very high-resolution polarization pictures by analyzing Botta's photographs.
Right. Now, I suppose this polarization measurement, maybe the Venus, too, is an example of the earlier equipment work that paid off in the late 50s.
That's right. Well, so anyway, as a result of that, what we thought was a definite detection of polarization, but we wanted to confirm it better. So then we built a rotating feed radiometer, and I don't remember when, but I guess the next year, confirmed it with a rotating feed and got better data and stuff and published it. And then somewhere along in those same years, I don't remember where, we also looked at Mars and Jupiter. And we, of course, looked to in this period, we looked at the strong radio sources and got what probably as good data on flux as anybody ever had, but we didn't ever present it that way or publish it that way.
In any of these projects, you haven't really mentioned other people as competitors or anything. Was NRL just pretty much on its own, or did you feel pressure from anyone else?
There weren't any competitors at these wavelengths, because we had the only 50-foot dish.
That must have been a nice position to be in.
Yeah. And your other question about weren't astronomers clamoring to come to NRL and look at stuff, I don't think they were, although even if they were, I might not have known about it, because they probably would have come to Hagen.
Yeah.
But I don't think, in general, astronomers were clamoring to do anything with any radio astronomy stuff. They were still taking a strictly hands-off attitude.
Yeah.
And looking down their noses.
And there were very few people that you could really call radio astronomers at that time. And
that's right. In fact, for the Venus measurement, the only real astronomer who paid much attention to it, and certainly the only one who gave us any support, was Kuiper. And guys like Menzel, they just poo-pooed it and said they didn't know what we were doing wrong, we must be doing something wrong. And did we really know what we were measuring? Did we really know what we were doing? All that kind of nonsense, you know. But Kuiper was not only right away receptive to believing that people other than astronomers could do things too, but he also was not so blind to the possibility that maybe they didn't know all about Venus and maybe it could be 600 degrees. And he, somewhere along in there, started Carl Sagan working on this, who was his graduate student in Chicago.
I see.
And Sagan was trying to explain the high temperature by greenhouse effect, basically.
In general, was there trouble in publishing radio astronomy papers in things like the Astrophysical Journal in the early 50s? Or?
Not as far as I know.
So they were accepted to that extent.
My impression would be that there may have been some trouble, but we certainly never encountered any real trouble. But maybe radio astronomers thought there would be trouble and didn't really try sometimes when they should have.
Yeah. But there still was some, as you've hinted, a lack of acceptance by most of the optical astronomers.
Lack of enthusiasm and acceptance. And, and there's always been a great reluctance for astronomers to accept NRL in any respect.
Why do you think that is? Just because?
Well, I think it's partly snobbery and partly that universities don't like competition from government installations.
That's interesting. Think that applies to the Naval Observatory also?
Yes. Sure. As far as research is concerned, they're perfectly happy to have them do ephemerides so they can use them.
Right.
Yeah, I think so. I don't have any information on that, of course, but I think so. I think it's still true today.
Well, they certainly look upon an academic post as, being a more favorable or exalted position or what have you than a civil service post. There's no doubt snobbery to that extent.
Yeah, I think there's always has been the feeling that only second-rate people would work for government, that sort of thing. If you're any good, you'd be at Harvard.
Yeah. Well, that covers up to the 84-foot. Did you work in the 84-foot at all?
No, or very little. Worked some on it, and we tried to make some polarization measurements. Well, we did make some polarization measurements at 10 centimeters. Well, that leads into all of this follow-up work on the planets and on the polarization. I mean, we looked for, even in the first measurements, we obviously looked for polarization in the other strong radius sources too, not just the crab.
Yeah.
And that may not be entirely true. I don't think we did look at Cygnus until 1961. I don't remember why that was. But anyway, and all these things led to other things. For example, couldn't understand why it didn't see polarization from Cassa. You obviously should. And there are only two possibilities. One was the magnetic field, well, three, I guess, not synchrotron radiation would be a possibility. The magnetic field was either entirely disordered or symmetrical. And that was the basis for our experiments a few years ago with the 140-foot map polarization of Cass A.
I see.
To find out, was it disordered or was it ordered? It turned out to be ordered. And so on.
At what point did the radio astronomy branch become such, you know, devoted to radio astronomy almost?
Oh, right? Yeah. Well, it was something like 1954, 53 or 54. It became radio astronomy branch. It still wasn't entirely devoted to radio astronomy by any means, but it was called then the radio astronomy branch. And at about that time, Hagen became division superintendent. And what was the division called then? I don't remember.
ANA?
Well, I think he renamed it ANA. I don't remember what it was called before.
And who became the branch head when Hagen moved up?
A guy named Ferris, who had been assistant branch head. He's a guy that Hagen got from RCA. He was a middle-aged fellow. And it was never quite clear why he got him or why he came here, because he had no interest in anything that was being done. He's a tube man. And he certainly had no interest in radio astronomy. But he had been assistant branch head for a long time, and also, obviously, again, you don't have to repeat this, but obviously Hagen had in mind that as division head, he was still going to run this branch.
Yeah.
Because he was still interested in radio astronomy. But anyway, Hagen only remained division head for something like a year, and then he took on this post as head of Vanguard, at which time Newell became division head. And Newell was division head then for two or three years until he left with the crowd that went to NASA.
And that's when Friedman took over? And who followed who? Ferris as branch head?
Well, Ferris then only remained as branch head for a year or two, and he found the situation untenable. So he went to South Carolina, University of South Carolina, and McLean became branch head. And that was in about probably 1956 or somewhere around there.
Now, had McLean acquired an interest in radio astronomy?
Oh, yes. I guess I skipped that. I said...
You said he started off at zero.
But I said he was not the least interested. In fact, he didn't want to do this at all. He was working on this Doppler navigation system, which he was interested in. But when they pointed the thing at these radio sources, he got mildly interested, I think. But then when they found this hydrogen line absorption, he became very interested. That converted him. But anyway, to answer your question, for a few years along in that period, probably still only about half the branches working on radio astronomy, it would have been at least until these people left or came or something.
Yeah,
there would have been
yeah.
a group like in the, say, 55, 56 area. It would have been Hagen and Haddock and McLean and Sloanaker and McCullough and Gibson and I may have forgotten some, but that's basically it.
Yeah.
And then a few other guys like Corbett.
There's another thing that we haven't mentioned is the Townes-Mazur collaboration.
I haven't got that far yet.
We're still...
We're about there. Well, anyway, you should also have somewhere in your records that shortly after the detection of Venus, Gibson and McEwen, who was a technician at that time here, Scotty, maybe you even heard about him, I don't know.
No, yeah.
They measured Venus at 9 millimeters, and they found the lower 400 degree temperature at 9 millimeters. So actually, if you're willing to accept the very marginal 10 centimeter result, the spectrum of Venus, essentially as it's known today, was found here in about 1956, 57.
Was that published in 9mm?
Yeah, that's in the Paris Symposium. I remember. Then that was extended further by Grant, I think, who measured Venus at 4mm using the 10-foot. It got still a lower temperature, 300 or something like that. So anyway, the spectrum of Venus was pretty well delineated at NRL. And of course, along about 1957 or 58, NRL got their first 85-foot, and Drake right away went on Venus 10 centimeters.
Yeah, that was 58. Right? That was the first time you had any competition of any kind. So is it the next step?
Well, the Times Measure, that was a collaboration that was set up, I guess initially between in talks between McLean and Towns. Towns had graduate students building measures, and he wanted to apply them in radio astronomy, and the 50-foot dish was the best place to do it. So he contacted McLean, and we worked with him, first of all, on the 3-centimeter measure on the 50-foot, and next, I guess it was the 21-centimeter measure that Arno Penzias built, and that was on the 84-foot. And then I guess next was Bill Rose, who built a 10-centimeter measure, and that was used on the 84-foot. And I don't think I've forgotten any.
Was there anything particularly troublesome in adapting these things as radiometers?
No. Not really. I mean, there was troubles, of course, but nothing basic.
Nothing to make them so they had to operate upside down, things like that. No problem.
Operate what?
Upside down and out in the elements.
Oh, no, that's a problem. I just had to, personally, now it has with mine, it's not such a bad problem. But just mounted at 45 degrees, so you can go up to the zenith and down to the horizon.
Well, let's see. The other thing that comes to my mind is that you've been involved in is very recent, namely the Towns collaboration with the water and ammonia lines. Of course, I know some of that myself, but I was just wondering if you would talk about just how that collaboration was set up. I mean, the way I know it is simply that Towns was looking for a bigger telescope, and since he'd worked with NRL before, it was sort of natural for him to give you a call.
Yeah, well, let's see, best I can remember it, he called and said they detected ammonia, and that he thought it'd be real good to look at it with higher resolution and so forth, and so we were planning to try to get something together and do this, and then a couple of weeks later or something like that, he called and said, well, they found this water, and this looks a lot more interesting.